Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How responsible are top American military commanders for the outcomes of the conflicts they are sent to engage in? And should they be held accountable by the Pentagon or by the president? My guest today has closely studied the history of U.S. military leadership since the Second World War, a period in which the armed forces have changed not only the ways candidates for generalship are cultivated and trained, but the circumstances under which they may be fired or reassigned if they fail to achieve their goals. Thomas E. Ricks is a fellow at the Center for a New American Security and contributing editor of Foreign Policy magazine. His new book is called The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. Tom, welcome back to Think.
Thank you.
You make it clear here that it's extraordinarily hard to be a general in a combat zone. Many experienced officers fail at it. But today you say that reality is rarely reflected in the way the Pentagon assigns, reassigns, and relieves generals of command.
Yeah, it's a big difference from World War II, which is the origin of the book for me. When I learned that in World War II, 10% of the guys who made it to combat command of a division were fired. When I learned this, I had just come out of Iraq, and I had been in a war where you could see nobody get fired, and in which, in today's Army, being a general is a lot like a university professor having tenure. You can get fired for embarrassing the institution, for getting caught with your pants down when they shouldn't be, but you don't get fired for being professionally incompetent. And that is a real change in how we run our military.
You have this quote in the book that I'm going to paraphrase here. A private who loses his rifle is more likely to be punished more severely than a general who loses a war.
Yeah, that was said by Lieutenant Colonel Paul Yingling, a very bright officer who I spent some time talking to up in Talafer, Iraq, in northwestern Iraq, up on the Syrian border. A guy so bright, by the way, that even though they study his writings at the Army War College, he wasn't admitted to the Army War College to go be a student there.
So let's go back and talk about George Marshall, who served as Army Chief of Staff throughout World War II. Not a guy, apparently, that you'd want to have a beer with, but undeniably a brilliant commander.
I'm not sure that George Marshall ever had a beer with anybody. but a real model for who you want to lead your military. In fact, picked by Franklin Roosevelt to be the Army Chief of Staff, partly because he had stood up to Roosevelt in meetings at the White House as a brigadier general. He had said, "No, Mr. President, I disagree." And that's kind of what Roosevelt knew he was looking for. He didn't want a yes man. The person who everybody expected to be Army Chief of Staff was a forgotten general named Hugh Drum, remembered only because a fort up in very far northern snowy New York, Fort Drum, is named for him. Marshall became Chief of Staff, told Roosevelt the straight truth during World War II, understood that the president was the commander-in-chief and had the final say and followed his orders even when he disagreed with them, but also had an interesting relationship with the president, not like you see with today's generals. One time when Franklin Roosevelt addressed him as George, he made it clear that he preferred to be called General Marshall. He refused to laugh at Roosevelt's jokes. Remember how we used to see generals and the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, going to visit President Bush at his ranch in Texas before the invasion of Iraq? George Marshall never went to Roosevelt's house in Hyde Park, New York, until Roosevelt's funeral, at which he was a pallbearer.
What was Marshall's MO for identifying and promoting promising junior officers?
Well, these days, the Army seems to just sort of say who's next in line, he gets the job. Marshall was very careful about picking certain people for certain jobs, and in fact spent a very large amount of his time figuring out what is this job that has opened up entail and what kind of officer fits into it. So going into World War II, he knew, number one, we were going to go in unprepared, which meant we were going to have some defeats at the beginning. Number two, we would be fighting overseas in partnership with allies. So he said, okay, the first thing, the fact we're going to be losing some battles means I need somebody who's optimistic, who's not going to get down, somebody who's going to keep up the morale of the team. The second thing, the fact that we're going to be fighting alongside allies, means I need somebody cooperative. So he reached down pretty far into the ranks for a young lieutenant colonel named Dwight Eisenhower, who at the beginning of 1940 was still the executive officer of an infantry regiment, a lieutenant colonel. And he began promoting him very rapidly. In about 5 years, in about 5 years, Eisenhower went from lieutenant colonel to five-star general. And he picked him specifically because Eisenhower was cheerful, optimistic, determined, ambitious, and a cooperative team player. And so he said, this is the type of guy I need as Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. By contrast, Marshall also knew very well George Patton. And Patton would not have been good in that job as Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. He probably would have blown up at the British and cursed them out and gotten in all sorts of trouble, even more than he did in World War II. But he knew that Patton, Marshall knew that Patton was very good at one thing, pursuing a fleeing enemy. He wasn't very good at defense. They weren't really sure he was that good simply at attacking. But they knew he was brilliant in pursuit. And they knew, Eisenhower and Marshall knew, that at some point in World War II, we would be chasing the Germans across Northern Europe. And when that moment came, Patton was brilliant. He spent the summer and fall of 44 chasing the Germans, and yes, he also helped come to the rescue at the Battle of Bulge that December. And it was a wonderful thing that he was there at the right time. A lot of American soldiers didn't die because George Patton was there to fight.
You know, it makes, Tom, such obvious sense for anyone who has worked in the corporate world that, for example, you don't want your chief of marketing promoted to CFO unless that person has the obvious skills. Why is this something that has fallen away from military command structure in modern times?
I think there are a couple of reasons. The first thing is World War II was a pretty clear war. We know who we were fighting. We knew that the road home went through Berlin, which means everybody's in it for the duration.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, we've fought small, murky, often unpopular wars, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq. And so it's harder to know what success looks like. You know, if you're fighting a war in which if you're not really just trying to gain ground, you're trying to gain political allegiance, it's pretty hard to know who's really succeeding and who isn't. You can know if you pay attention, though. It was pretty clear in Iraq that General David Petraeus did better than other generals in 2003-2004. When he commanded the 101st Airborne Infantry, 101st Air Assault Division. And then later on, in his second tour, when he was the overall commander for Iraq, it was pretty clear that he did better dealing with the insurgency than had previous generals. So success is harder to figure out, but it is still there. The second villain, I think, in the piece is rotation. When you rotate generals in and out every year, it's very easy for a general to say, oh, yeah, I was successful, and then I left. It's harder for a guy, if he's staying there for 3 or 4 years, to say, oh, yeah, we're making a lot of success. You're just not seeing it yet.
Hmm.
And finally, when you're fighting a small, unpopular war, it's natural not to want to admit to small failures or even bigger ones. So Matthew Ridgway, a Marshall protege, was the commander in Korea late in 1950. In early 51, he began firing commanders. He wanted to fire 5 of the 6th Division commanders in Korea. And the Pentagon wrote to him and said, look, we don't really like what you're doing. If you need to get rid of these guys, go ahead, but do it on the down low. That is, you know, don't make it public, find places to park these guys. And that's when the Army really began backing away from the tradition of swift relief, which was not just a Marshall thing. It goes back to the Revolution and to the Civil War, which is successful generals get promoted, failing generals get fired. During World War II, Marshall basically gave his generals 90 days to succeed, get killed, or get removed. And we don't have that in the military anymore, and the military is worse off for it.
And do you think that pressure, the realization that they had 3 months to make it or break it, also affected the kinds of decisions these generals were making?
Yeah, I think it did. And it's a good question because it changes the whole battlefield structure. If you have an incentive for risk-taking and everybody else does, you tend to have a more aggressive force. You tend to take more risk-taking decisions. Not wild decisions, but prudent risk-taking. When you don't have that, when there's no incentive for success, when the incentive is simply to do your year and go home, you get a more cautious military. I think a military that becomes complacent and satisfied with mediocrity. And by the way, I want to emphasize, I'm not talking about the enlisted soldier or the sergeants. Our military today at that level, the enlisted level, is probably better than it's ever been. These soldiers are well-trained, well-equipped, they're in cohesive units. But they are not well led at the top of the military. The generals are not as good as the soldiers they lead.
In fact, you make the case that in several situations in Iraq and Afghanistan, it has been the very well-trained, highly disciplined forces at the lower ranks that have allowed generals to keep going as long as they did.
Yeah, it was actually an argument I first heard from a very smart Brigadier General, Sean McFarland, who was based in Texas for a while. He had been a colonel in Ramadi, and he made the point that because our soldiers were so good, that they kind of bailed out the generals. And think of it. Think if we'd been had sent a draftee force into Iraq. I don't think we could have dithered for as long as we did in Iraq if we had draftees who were sort of getting disgusted and protesting and so on. But because we had good, young, trained soldiers, they could actually have an effect on the ground even if they were not well led. By not well led, what I mean especially is they had generals who didn't understand the war they were fighting, who didn't know what success looked like, who didn't know even what they were trying to do on the ground. Remember, this is an invasion in which our forces got to Baghdad, and there were no orders, there was no sense of what to do next. People just basically stopped and sat down. It was a terrible thing.
Does that speak to failure on the part of the Pentagon and ultimately the White House to instruct properly these generals?
I think it's failure of first the Army, because the Army tends to train our generals but not educate them. And the difference is you train for known task. You train for things you know you're going to have to do. This is how you fire a gun.
Mm-hmm.
You educate for the unknown, for the ambiguous situation, for uncertainty, when people need to think critically. And a lot of our generals are well-trained but not well-educated. When they had a situation that they were not prepared for, that they were not trained for, they didn't know what to do. General Petraeus, again, being the big exception.
And I guess along with this additional level of accountability that existed in World War II and a bit beyond, there was also more latitude for generals to do as they saw fit for the amount of time they were allowed to stay.
Yeah, go and try and succeed. And that's why in World War II, you have a lot of young generals rising up, names we know now because of the martial system of promoting quickly successful young officers. This isn't just Eisenhower. Another good example is James Gavin, known as the boy general, because he looked so young when he was in command of the 82nd Airborne. In fact, at one point at the end of the war, a German general was trying to surrender. And Gavin said, well, I'm a general, and the general didn't believe him. Just because he said, no, you look like a kid, and he really did. Another young officer is Matthew Ridgway, who goes from being a colonel at the beginning of the war to, I believe, a three-star general by the end of the war, very successfully leading at the regimental, division, and corps levels.
To what extent is the bureaucratized system we have now of promoting colonels to generals a factor of the desire to ensure that those who are not white men have the opportunities they deserve and don't get passed over unfairly?
I don't think it has a lot to do with it. Overwhelmingly, our generals are still white men, and overwhelmingly, they're still mediocre. There are some black generals, and there are some good black generals, and some mediocre black generals. I think the real problem, though, is a word you mentioned, bureaucratization. They started acting like a bureaucracy. They started acting like a union or a guild, in which the generals are looking out for their own interests before they look out for those of the soldiers or those of the nation. So in Vietnam, no generals get fired hardly. The only general I can remember getting fired in Vietnam as a division commander was James Baldwin, fired as the commander of the AmeriCal division in 1971. Totally forgotten.
Thomas E. Ricks is my guest. He's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security and contributing editor of Foreign Policy. His new book is called The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Thomas E. Ricks, a fellow at the Center for a New American Security and contributing editor of Foreign Policy magazine. He's got a new book out called The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. You mentioned, Tom, just before the break, that there was a single general fired during Vietnam, and we've all sort of forgotten his name. Talk about what happened to General Westmoreland, who by most accounts made some disastrous miscalculations.
Well, Westmoreland is an interesting example of what happens when generals refuse to fire other generals. Presidents start firing generals is what happens. When the generals won't police their own ranks, then the civilians, getting unhappy with the course of a war, start removing people. So in Vietnam, first Paul Harkins is fired, forgotten general, and he's replaced by Westmoreland, who is fired. Likewise in Korea, MacArthur got fired. Later on in Iraq, George Casey is fired, and of course in Afghanistan, McKiernan and McChrystal are fired. The commonality, though, is that they were not removed by the military. They were removed by civilians unhappy with the course of war. The problem with this is when you only fire the top guy, it's like trying to run a baseball team and firing the manager of the team every time you start losing a ball game. Yes, sometimes the manager has to go. Clearly, Bobby Valentine had to leave the Red Sox. I say that as a suffering Red Sox fan.
I'll have to take your word for it because I don't follow the Red Sox.
But sometimes, more often, you don't want to fire the manager. All you need is a relief pitcher, mm-hmm. which is to say a lower-ranking temporary change at a lower echelon of the game or of the war. That's what we lost. And so you wind up with a guy like Westmoreland, who was not very bright, who was not well-respected by his peers, who was flailing about and left in place so long that by the time his successor, General Abrams, Creighton Abrams, started fighting more effectively, he really didn't have an army left. The army we had in the field in Vietnam in 1969, was basically a chewed up army in which the NCO Corps, the sergeants, were all gone. Everybody, all the good sergeants had done one or two tours and either left the military or got a rear echelon job. The troops we had in frontline units overwhelmingly were green, undertrained, and new. I remember reading about one infantry company in Vietnam in 1969 or 70. It had, in about 150 men, it had three soldiers, including the company commander, who had been in the Army more than 2 years. Hmm. That's a very green outfit to have in the field.
And ultimately, do I have this right? Westmoreland was promoted.
Yeah, he got kicked upstairs to be Army Chief of Staff. As I said, it's hard to admit to failure sometimes. And so they basically just found another slot for him, not unlike what President George W. Bush did with George Casey in Iraq. Out of an honest, sincere feeling that Casey had tried his best and had done what he'd been told to do, President Bush decided rather than simply retire Casey out of the Army, he made him Chief of Staff of the Army.
Does that just exacerbate the tensions that already and always have existed between civilian and military leadership in this country?
I think actually what it does is exacerbate the tensions between military leaders and their subordinates.
Hmm.
Everybody in the Army knew that Casey had not done very well in Iraq. And there was a lot of head-scratching among battalion commanders and company commanders. Why are they making that guy the chief of staff of the Army? Why, if you think he failed in Iraq, should he leave the institution? And so I think it actually was undermined confidence in among soldiers in their senior military leadership and in the civilian leadership.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Levi in Carrollton. Hi, Levi.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The military-industrial complex has grown significantly since the days of World War II, and I would love to know how that has affected the way generals have been treated since then.
Well, I think the bureaucratization of the military, the growth of, as you say, the military-industrial complex, did play a big role in that because it did make it more of a bureaucracy looking out for its own interest. A second effect of the Cold War was kind of atrophying strategic thinking. For a long time, when our enemy was the Soviet Union, we didn't have to think a lot about strategy. We knew who the enemy was. We knew how they operated. They were kind of big, dumb, slow, and cautious. A brontosaurus, the perfect enemy. When the Soviet Union evaporated in the late 1980s, suddenly we were facing a much different, uncertain world. Yet we had a generation of generals who had not been trained and educated, more importantly, to think strategically, to look at a situation critically and say, huh, I was never prepared for this, but a general like Petraeus could say, okay, how do I address this? What are the key issues here? How do I identify them? What are the various ways of dealing with them? Petraeus did some pretty nervy stuff in Iraq that people tend to forget. For example, he put the Sunni insurgency, 100,000 fighters who've been killing Americans, on the American payroll. He basically paid them to stop fighting. They didn't surrender. They were allowed to keep their weapons and actually keep their formations and stay in place. It was kind of more a ceasefire. Even nervier, I asked him one day, General Petraeus, how did you get President Bush to agree to this, to put in the Sunni fighters who were killing Americans on the American payroll? He said, oh, I didn't ask. That's nervy. He basically had taken it on himself and allowed the president, if it blew up, the president can simply fire him and say Petraeus was off on his own on this.
I want to jump here for just a minute because we keep using this word fire, and in some cases these generals have been completely sort of drummed out of the military, and in other cases they have been reassigned or called back home and given another job.
That's a good point. In World War II, relief was very common. Of the 155 men who commanded divisions in combat in World War II, 16 were fired. But as you say, there was a second chance frequently involved. Of the 16 generals who were fired as division commanders in the Army in World War II, 5 were given other divisions in combat in World War II. And many other generals who got fired got good training jobs, not the best job in the world, but they certainly weren't disgraced. They certainly weren't seen as failures. They went on. Some of the generals who got fired were demoted to colonel in World War II, and then during the 1950s, one of them became a 3-star general, Hanging Sam Williams. So it was a much more fluid system, a much more dynamic system, a system that said, you're not the right guy for this job at this time, but it doesn't mean you're a bad guy or that you lack character or you're a coward. It simply means we're going to move you on here, and there's a good chance you'll get another chance down the road. We lost that system entirely, and I think it's been to the detriment of our military.
So if generals like David Petraeus and Ray Odierno were especially nimble and able to respond to changing circumstances, is there something we can look at in their background, in their education, in their temperament that made them different from people like Sanchez and George Casey?
Yeah. Petraeus had a good civilian education. He had a Ph.D. from Princeton. Interestingly, Petraeus also had been successful in Iraq. He liked Washington and talking to reporters and politicians. Now, in the Army's book, that was kind of 3 strikes against him. Ph.D., successful general, and he likes reporters and politicians. So he was very much an outsider in the Army. Odierno was a little bit less of an outsider and actually had a pretty bad first tour in Iraq in which he led the 4th Infantry Division and just rounded up 10,000 Iraqi males and shipped them off to Abu Ghraib without really trying to figure out who they were. And that helped create the Abu Ghraib situation. That said, Odierno was able to adjust when he recognized, I've got to operate differently, I've got to operate better. When he came back as Petraeus' number 2 guy in Iraq in late 2006, he operated very differently. So I think the background you want is a guy who is able to stand at arm's length, examine the situation critically, and come up with different solutions. And apparently, the track record says that most of our generals are not capable of doing that these days.
How was nobody at the top of the command structure fired over Abu Ghraib?
It stuns me even now, and it stunned a lot of people in the Army. Brigadier General Janice Karpinski almost certainly should have been relieved. She was not, in part because she was due to rotate home soon, so why go all the trouble? There's another reason that rotation of commanders is pernicious. But also probably Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, the commanding officer ultimately over her, also probably should have been fired over Abu Ghraib. I've heard the argument made that also General John Abizaid, the commander at Central Command at the time, should have been fired, if only because he hadn't relieved the 2 people beneath him. This was another thing in World War II. Omar Bradley remembered as such a warm and fuzzy guy because of the Carl Malden character, the character played by Carl Malden in the movie Patton. Omar Bradley told his subordinates, either you fire the people below you who fail, or I'll fire you, which is a real incentive to make sure that you reward success and punish failure, because otherwise it could be your neck.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Mark in North Richland Hills. Hi, Mark.
Yes, good afternoon. A great discussion. Just really a question for your guest there. From my readings, I understand that Abe Lincoln didn't seem to have too much problem whatsoever in either firing generals or replacing them. Or would your guest agree with that?
Yes, Mark, and I should have mentioned that. Lincoln, in many ways, one of our gentler presidents in personality, was one of our tougher presidents on generals. And he searched for a general long and hard until he finally came across Ulysses S. Grant, a tough-minded general who was willing to fight hard. And again, so that points to how George Marshall was in the American tradition, the American Revolution, the Civil War, and World War I all saw many generals relieved. It's a recent phenomena in which generals don't get relieved, moved on, replaced if they don't succeed, and we are worse off for it. I mean, this is not a revolutionary thing I'm talking about. You can summarize it in one word, accountability. If you make people accountable, your organization will be more successful. If you tolerate failure, your organization will be less successful. Veterans Day is coming up, by the way, this Sunday. And if you want to support troops, if you want to thank veterans, you should give them something they deserve, which is good military leadership. And I worry that in our veneration of the troops, we don't ask enough tough questions of our generals these days.
I'm glad you brought that up, because do you have the sense that our desire to do the right thing for the troops means we never question anything done by the military? We're happy to question, say, the White House for decisions it's made, but we don't look at anything within the military for fear of coming across as unsupportive of the men and women fighting on the battlefield.
Exactly. I think we are all kind of snake bit by Vietnam. We realize the way that Americans dealt with troops in Vietnam was bad, and we want to do differently. But it's not good to confuse the troops with the generals. By not questioning the generals, we're not helping the troops. We are hurting the troops. Right now, the generals are kind of using the troops as human shields, hiding behind them, and we should not allow that to happen. Our troops deserve to have their generals questioned and pushed hard to be good leaders.
Can you speak just a minute? What does it mean to be a general? What's the difference in terms of the understanding of the position itself between a colonel and a general?
Well, the term is actually quite precise. When you become an army general, you remove from your lapel the branch insignia that officers wear. Branch insignia would mean, like, for infantry, it's crossed rifles. For engineers, it's a tiny little triple turreted castle. For cavalry, it's cross swords and so on. You take off that branch insignia and you become a generalist. I actually went once years ago to the Army's school for new brigadier generals. And one of the points they made to them was that until now, as a colonel, you represented your branch of the military, aviation, infantry, engineers, and so on. Now, by becoming a general, you represent the Army. You are a general of the U.S. Army. Now, that's what they are. What do they do all day is the second question. And this is why in the book I actually took the example of the Chosin Reservoir campaign in the Korean War, which is interesting of itself, but also presents a good test case, because you have the Marine Corps, a Marine Corps general fighting on the west side of the Chosin Reservoir, and an Army unit fighting on the east side. And so you get kind of a laboratory test case looking at, okay, what were the situations presented, which are very similar on each side of the reservoir, and how did generals respond to them? As has happened in that case, and this is not always the case, but in that case, the Marine general, O.P. Smith, did a great job, and the Army generals who were overseeing the unit on the east side of the reservoir did a terrible job. The result was that while the Marines had to retreat from Chosin Reservoir, they got all of their Marines who were alive out, and they got all their wounded out and most of their dead. 15,000 Marines made it out. On the east side of the reservoir, the Army regiment that was there was destroyed. They had a 90% casualty rate. Their leaders died, and the survivors stumbled out to the Marines' lines, and the Marines took them in and got them out. A really shocking example of good generalship and bad generalship. If O.P. Smith, the Marine commander at Chosin Reservoir, had done differently, probably 15,000 Marines would have been wiped out. We now know from documents the Chinese government released much later that the Chinese government troops going into Korea in December 1950 had been given orders to destroy the Marines. This was going to be an example to the Americans. Had that happened, it would have been the greatest military disaster in our history. And either we would have gone and used nuclear weapons in Korea, or we would have withdrawn from the Korean War altogether, and it would be communist now. Either of those outcomes would have been terrible outcomes. And it was O.P. Smith, this forgotten Marine general, who prevented that from happening. And to me, he's a real American hero, and it's one reason I spent a lot of time in the book writing about him. Just a fascinating character and a great general, born in Texas, by the way.
Is there something we can do, Tom, to improve the quality of education for the young men and women who are likely to be considered for generalship later on?
One thing you could do is give young officers a good education, but there's a good education available for a lot of young officers, especially those who go through the ROTC program, the Reserve Officer Training Corps.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the education is as good at West Point. It's more focused on engineering. Doesn't give us, I think, exactly the sorts of officers we need these days. But the second thing is you can encourage officers at mid-career level, majors and lieutenant colonels, to get a good civilian master's degree and even to get PhDs. Some of the best generals I knew in Iraq, General Petraeus being one, Lieutenant General Jim Dubik being another, were well-educated in the civilian world, and they had sat alongside very critical students and professors and had to learn to think independently.
Thomas E. Ricks is my guest. He's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security and author of the new book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Thomas E. Ricks. He is a contributing editor of Foreign Policy magazine and author of the new book, The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. We have an email here from David in Plano who writes, "Where does General Douglas MacArthur fall into this picture? Based on his spotty performance over his career, I would have thought he'd have been relieved in the very beginning of World War II."
It's a very good question. MacArthur was a real difficult question for me in the book. He's a fascinating guy. He's a real piece of work, too. MacArthur's an anomaly. He precedes Marshall, not only in the Army. He's older than Marshall, but he also had been chief of staff of the Army before Marshall. He was kind of in place. There was not a lot Marshall could do about him. MacArthur managed to be insubordinate not to just one president, we remember his insubordination with Truman, but to three presidents, first to President Hoover during the Bonus March in the early 1930s in Washington, second to President Franklin Roosevelt. Early in Roosevelt's presidency, MacArthur basically said, when we're losing the next war because you won't pay for my army, I want the dying soldier to curse you, my name. And Roosevelt said, "Douglas, you must not talk to the president like that." And then later in Korea. I think part of it was the politics of MacArthur. He was known to be a right-wing isolationist. And Roosevelt, the most Machiavellian of presidents, very careful in his politics, I think wanted to have MacArthur inside the tent pissing out, as President Johnson would have said, rather than outside the tent pissing in. And so they kept him in the Army, kept him in the military, and I think that helped shore up support on the right wing and among isolationists, for World War II. Now, MacArthur thought he was going to be president. His subordinates wrote in their diaries in 1943, they thought, that from the way MacArthur was talking, that he would run for president and win in 1944. Again in 1952, MacArthur seemed to think he might become president. In fact, people forget, Mark MacArthur gave the keynote address at the Republican Chicago Convention in 1952, and I think he went in there kind of expecting that he would be nominated by the Republicans. As it happened, the Republicans nominated another general, MacArthur's former aide, Dwight Eisenhower, a more moderate man. And interestingly, they were each supported by a group of Texas oil men, MacArthur by sort of extremist right-wing oil men, and Eisenhower by more moderate Republican, but still conservative, Texas oil men. And they got Eisenhower elected president by bankrolling him. I think it was quite humiliating for MacArthur to see his former aide, the guy who used to sit outside basically as his secretary in the outer office, to see him be nominated and win the presidency. And it's interesting that MacArthur and Eisenhower were never close while Eisenhower was in the White House.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Ken calling from Parker County. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Rick, you touched on it briefly about the Academy graduates, which we refer to them as ring knockers. I did two tours in Vietnam as a commissioned officer, and the ring knockers had their own little group, so to speak. Overall, how did the ring knockers factor into the decline in the general officer staff? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Sure, Ken, and also thanks for your service in Vietnam. It's hard to tell quite where the West Point strain is. I do think that West Point cadets do not get a broad education. They get a difficult education. They get yelled at a lot by the upperclassmen. But there's no evidence that they get particularly good educations. And it's enormously expensive compared to Reserve Officer Training Corps graduates, ROTC cadets, who get an alternative source of commissioning there. So I actually think we should reexamine the academies, partly because I'm a fiscal conservative. I don't think we should throw away the taxpayers' money. And it costs, I think, about 10 times as much money to get an officer through the West Point system than through the ROTC system. And I don't think we should just idly say, let's keep up that system if it's 10 times more expensive and the product isn't as good.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jerry in Dallas. Hey, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question or comment is this. I've always believed that that war should be declared as it's supposed to be. There hasn't been a declared war by Congress since the Second World War. And all of these conflicts that we've been in were pushed in by the president, and there was way too much opposition in the Congress, and I'm sure that's why they didn't do it. But also, since Clinton, the presidents have seemed to be very uncomfortable by being commander-in-chief, and they seem to ignore it. You can tell by their demeanor when they step off of the helicopter coming back to the White House. They have a very difficult time saluting because they don't know anything about about being in the military or what that entails, and so they have seemed to ignore it. And certainly, none of them has known the generals like Roosevelt and Marshall and the people whom they dealt with and put in place. It seems to me that there's no way that can work appropriately except to fuddle through as we seem to have been doing over the last few years.
What do you think, Tom?
I think it's a very good point Jerry makes, and it's something I worry about a lot, which is our politicians today, starting with our presidents, do not know a lot about the military. They have not served in the military. They don't know a lot of people who have served in the military. It's not their milieu. Same is true of Congress. As late as the Vietnam War, two-thirds of the members of Congress had served in the military. Now, they weren't all generals. A lot of them had just been privates and sergeants. But that's not a bad thing when you're having an Armed Services Committee hearing and some generals up there talking away, for the chairman to say, wait a second, when I was a sergeant, You know, that's not the way it was. You may have thought it was that way, General, but it wasn't. And we don't get that as much anymore, that's a bad thing. What do we do about it? I think the burden is on our military to explain themselves more, to step up and say, Mr. President, you need to understand how this works. But that's difficult for our generals, especially if they have not been taught how to do that.
What role do you think Congress does have in increasing accountability within the military?
Congress is in the same position as the president. They don't have a lot of military experience. They don't even know the right questions to ask. And Democrats, I think, particularly, are kind of afraid of the military. There's not a lot of upside here for them, and there's a lot of downside. So they kind of just sort of, when they deal with the Pentagon, it's like dealing with a schoolyard bully and giving your lunch money to him. You don't give them to him because you want to. You give it to him because you're afraid of him. So I see President Obama and Governor Romney in the debates sort of each talking about how much money they're going to give to the military. I'm not sure we need to give the military that much money these days. We should be asking, are we getting our money's worth? Why, as our wars are ending in Iraq and Afghanistan, is Governor Romney talking about increasing the defense budget? It doesn't make sense. Usually when wars end, your spending should go down. Also, for the last 10 years, since 9/11, we have just had a fire hose of money shooting at the military. We have basically given them the money and said, figure out how to spend it later. So you have a generation of people in the military who have only known basically a blank check. That is not historically how we've run our military. It's not a good way to run a military. But these are not people accustomed to thinking of finding effective, less expensive ways of doing things. And I think we should. I don't know whether you can cut the military budget by 10%, by 20%, or by 30%. But I think it's a question that needs to be asked.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have now another Thomas on the line. This is Thomas from Fort Worth. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Fantastic show. Just a little background on myself, not much, but I'm a 30-year Army man. I'm a colonel in the Army Reserve. And I find myself agreeing with virtually everything Thomas has said. I haven't had a chance to listen to the entire conversation, one, because I was dropped, but two, I started in the car. But one of the key problems that I've seen over the years, and I should tell you, I started out as a 17-year-old private, so I spent substantial time in the enlisted ranks before I became a commissioned officer. And that is during the down times in the military, that is where we're not actively engaging in warfare, there's a definite zero defects mentality that creeps into the officer corps, where if you do not belong to the West Point Protection Association, that is, if you're not a ring knocker, if you're not a West Point officer, your chance for survival is substantially less if you make any kind of a mistake. And I think the problem with that is, just going back to one of Thomas's comments about one of the officers who had been relieved, I believe, as a colonel and then made it 3 stars in the following war. I personally knew a lieutenant general that had been relieved as lieutenant and then became the commander of 5th Army later on in his career. And I think if the zero defects mentality had been in play at that time, he would have been long gone. And I think Grant's another example. You know, that's going way back, but, you know, Grant more or less was drummed out as a major, came back, and you know the rest of the story on that.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Thomas, and I want to make sure that Tom has a chance to respond.
Well, I appreciate them, too, because this is actually one of the problems when you run in the way we run our military these days. When you allow incompetence, you encourage micromanagement because nobody trusts their subordinates, because people are just being passed along through the system. And so commanders are worried that the guy below them needs to be watched closely. Rather than just let the guy go to his job, everybody micromanages. And the good people get tired of that and start leaving. And you wind up with generals who are great micromanagers but not great leaders. And I think we have a lot of those these days.
I ask this not to be cynical, but in all sincerity, do we run a risk if we start relieving poorer generals, poorer officers of higher rank of their jobs that we clean out the ranks of senior officers?
Somebody the other day asked me, Tom, what percentage of Army generals do you think need to be relieved? And I said, the exact percentage of those who are failing right now. I don't know what that percentage is.
Mm-hmm.
What you find, though, is if you started relieving a few people, you don't need to relieve that many people. What you find is that you will encourage the others. You incentivize success. Right now, we've incentivized mediocrity, moving towards the average. Don't stick your head up, keep your nose clean, and you'll just chug along through your career. If you said you must succeed, then people would try to succeed. One or two firings would famously encourage the others to start acting differently, to take some risk. And I think you actually would improve your crop of officers. It's not the raw material of generals. It's the incentive structure that they face when they become generals.
What do we do to ensure that the generals we do send into combat zones fully understand the situation on the ground?
They need to be able to go and study a situation, and they need to be able to say, hey, nothing that in my training ever prepared me for this. How do I think about it differently? You saw this done by Petraeus in both his his command tours there, and you saw it done by Odierno in his second tour there. They brought in other people. I was really struck that Odierno, knowing he needed different perspectives, brought in as his political advisor, not somebody from the State Department, but a British female who was anti-American, basically a pacifist, and an expert in Arab affairs. Her name is Emma Skye, fascinating character. She would argue with Odierno. She would tell him when she thought she was wrong. At one point, she stormed out of a meeting after they were showing video of a helicopter killing insurgents. And she stood up and said, you know, you people, this is the American equivalent of jihadi beheading videos. That's a fascinating thing to say to a bunch of commanders in the U.S. Army. And they thought she was wrong, but she was making them think differently. Odierno recognized that he needed to think differently. He needed to hear voices like that, and he brought them inside his tent. Now, it's to the great credit of the U.S. Army that they did that. They brought in a woman like Emma Skye to advise them. Emma Skye, this British woman, said to me once, the British Army would have never done this. They would never have brought in a female who's anti-military and given her a seat at the table to argue.
Thomas E. Ricks is a fellow at the Center for New American Security and contributing editor of Foreign Policy magazine. His new book is called The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today. Tom, it's always fascinating. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed it.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free every day at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.